everyone, it's Emma from Tales of Ordinary Times. I'm just giving you a quick heads up that the sound in this episode has a couple of issues. Ruth and I recorded the first six episodes of the podcast as a bit of a taster before we'd invested in microphones to see if we were really ready to give podcasting a go. Stick with it though, the content's always great even if the sound has its moments. Enjoy the episode.
Welcome to Tales of Ordinary Times, where we dust off the bookshelf of history to bring you stories of everyday places, objects, and people from the past. This is Dr. Ruth Colton, a historian and specialist in material culture.
Hello, and this is Emma Richmond, a history superfan whose expertise is in communicating new research.
Hello.
Throughout this mini-series, we have been looking at the development of public parks from their inception all the way through to the wars. We've discussed the ways people used the parks and the hidden messages and ideas inscribed upon the landscape. Today, we are bringing the series to a close with a discussion on the parks today, their ongoing significance, and what the future holds for these special spaces.
For this final episode, we are delighted to welcome another expert voice onto the podcast. We're joined today by Dr. Abby Gilmore. She's a senior lecturer at the University of Manchester in Arts Management and Cultural Policy. Hello, Abby. Welcome. Do you want to say a little bit more about what you do?
Hi, thank you very much for having me. And yeah, what do I do? Well, I work with the Institute for Cultural Practices, which is based at the University of Manchester. And what we do is we primarily undertake research on cultural practices and teach students who are undertaking MA programmes. And we've got three MA programmes in arts management, in heritage studies, and in art gallery and museum studies. So yeah, all of our research kind of sits around those areas. We do a lot of work that is both practice-based, but also working with and collaboratively with practitioners. And my area of expertise really comes from an interdisciplinary field, which is critical cultural policy studies.
Thank you very much for joining us, Abby. First thing I wanted to ask you is, a lot of the people who I know research in the field of parks got into it because of a personal connection to a space. So certainly my work was informed by the personal connection I have with the park that my grandma grew up near in Gateshead. And that really kind of shaped the way I looked at the park and how I wanted my research to go. What drew you to researching the parks? And do you have any kind of special memories or special connection to park spaces?
Yeah, that's a good question. What actually drew me to researching parks was a research project that wasn't anything to do with parks, actually. And it was looking at how people understand the cultural value of what they do in their everyday lives. It was a large mixed method study that ran from 2012 to 2016, actually 2017. It was led by the University of Manchester, but it involved other universities. And we had a whole series of different sorts of research activities going on around different places in England and Scotland. And the research that strands that I was leading in was looking at Manchester and Salford in particular. And the basic question of this research project was, how do you understand what the value of culture is to people in their everyday lives without asking them the question, do you take part in the arts? And what we were trying to do was get under the skin or under the radar of some of the ways that in arts and cultural policy, arts organisations and funders are often trying to identify the value and benefits of what happens when people take part in the arts by asking them sort of the wrong questions. And some of those questions completely obscure the real value of what people do and what that means to them culturally. What happened very quickly with that, through long semi-structured interviews with people about, you know, what they did in their spare time, what that meant to them, where they went in their local areas, what local groups they joined in with, what places they avoided. What that started to tell us was that parks are phenomenally important to people's lives and in all kinds of really interesting ways. And we did other kinds of research where, you know, we use other research methods to kind of get at that. So Adele F. Edwards, who was the research associate on the project, comes from a sort of more anthropological background. Luciana Lang, also an anthropologist, and they used ethnographic methods to explore what people were doing in the public spaces of parks. And we also did some kind of mapping of where people go in their everyday lives through other data sources. So that was the official academic bit, was there was clear evidence bubbling up through these interviews where people were referencing, talking about parks far more than they were talking about the formal cultural institutions that we might identify with the Arts Council England or with government funding or with people's musical cultural tastes. And we also found out that people have very creative and cultural associations with what they do with parks as well. I just wanted to mention my own personal connection because you raised that, because I think that was something that came up really clearly in the interviews as well. Even if people, and some of these people, these, you know, the interviews were happening at a time where it was just pre the referendum in communities that were highly diverse, but also with high levels of deprivation in some areas and also very kind of mobile populations. And also with the other sorts of indicators that you get in some of those areas with poor health and so on. It was a time where there'd been the bedroom tax. So there was a lot of feeling around some of our interviewees about anger. And there were some of the things that I suppose we saw coming through in the referendum with social division. And so some people weren't even able to go to parks anymore. They were too ill or it didn't fit with their everyday life. But the people who were talking about the value of them were referencing these memories that were really, really important that they kept in their own cultural lives. So they were happy that there were these parks existed, even though they couldn't visit them. They were also recognizing that they made their, I'm sure you've looked at it in your own research, Ruth, that how the housing market values are better if you've got a park close by.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then some of the follow-up work we were doing as part of the research also started to tease out who people felt are responsible for parks and who needs to look after them. But maybe we'll come on to that later on. Yeah. So just very quickly, my personal recollection, which your question reminded me of, was thinking about, and it's way back in my academic life, if you like, in that when I was doing my PhD, which is at Leicester, I mean, my everyday connection to the parks is as a dog owner. So I go and do the everyday dog walking in the parks. And it's so important to our mental health. It's so important to my dog's mental health and physical health. And I had a dog when I was a very similar little dog when I was living in Leicester. And I lived opposite the park and used to be able to take the dog for a walk before going into lectures or to give seminars or to do whatever I was doing during my PhD. And Victoria Park is one of those big parks that was based on a race course just next to the university. And you could see a lot of communities there in one space. And you could go and use it as a student in the summer. Everybody knows who's been a student at university, the best weather always comes just when your exams are on. So you could go and do your revision sitting in the park. But then, yeah, and you'd watch the season. So I had this kind of relationship with this particular space, which I've only found out more in terms of its history, more latterly, when I've been looking at some of the historical backgrounds to the way the parks have been established. But one of the things that really struck me were how people behaved. And there was a particular character, and I bet we've all got we've got our park characters somewhere. Leicester's very diverse area, has a high Muslim or South Asian population. And so there's also a lot of connections with the space in terms of those different communities and how they may have regular practices that they will undertake in public parks, so feeding the birds and so on. But there was one guy who would be in the park, I think almost every day, and he twirled. He would get into the public space and he would twirl around, and he had, I'm sorry, I don't know the technical name for the outfit that he was wearing, you know, so it's a long white shirt. And so just to see this man twirling and for whatever reason in this space was just amazing. And it's always stuck with me and been part of my education, really.
So I just wanted to ask as well, you mentioned it, the great big mixing pot that parks offer up, and whether or not that's always been something which has been one of the key messages of the parks, is that they're supposed to be accessible for all. I mean, whether or not the behaviour in them is supposed to be regulated heavily, but they're supposed to be for everyone to come together and to mix. And it sounds like that's one of the enduring aspects of the park. And I wonder if that was one of the reasons why people felt that parks were so important compared to other cultural sites, was because of that sense of belonging at all, if that was something you'd got across at all.
I think very much so. And it's something that I've wanted to and have been exploring further in my research since we finished the project with Understanding Everyday Participation. I've done various collaborative projects in different parks in Manchester and Salford. I'm very parochial about my research, always tends to be close to home. And with those thoughts in mind about what's happening in terms of how people connect to this public space and how actually they produce the public space through their participation. and how that actually, you know, so some of the interviews from UEP is what we call Understanding Everyday Participation, UEP project, they were talking about how actually some of the parks were no-go zones, or some zones in the parks were places where they didn't feel that they could go because either there were particular sorts of practices that represented things that were offensive to their religious beliefs or their cultural traditions. So whether that's about Orthodox Jewish communities not wanting to go where there were too many genteel because actually it was not what was expected, and so would avoid parks at certain times, or whether it was because there were young people and the kind of aggression that you might feel. I mean, again, another thing I'm sure many people will identify with is that parks have teenage time, don't they? So there's certain zones when all of a sudden, you know, you'll see the playground and then all of a sudden it switches from this kind of noisy, happy, busy space with prams and mums to being a space where the swing is going and the teenagers that are taking over that space. And one of the interviewees I remember was talking about how he felt he couldn't walk his dog in a particular space because he was actually worried about, and I believe it was about a homophobic assault or attack. So he'd had a previous experience, which meant going into this space was potentially threatening. So there are ways that the things that people do in parks make them not so accessible, not so public. But there's also the fact that you can, so me watching the Twirling Man in Leicester, you can see things happening and you can have a curiosity. And I think seeing the range of humanity is really important, isn't it? That's the kind of how do parks support cultural integration. It's that visibility. And an academic called Anna Barker, who's at Leeds and who does amazing work on parks, talks about it as, and I love this phrase, the idea of mediated conviviality.
That's a nice phrase, yeah.
So, yeah, there's the space and we can conviviality, we can live together with it. And parks underwrite quite a lot of the risk of coming into contact with something you don't understand or don't know, because you can have quite a fleeting encounter. You don't have to invest too much in it, but you can learn from it.
I think it's really clear as well that parks have continued this role of as spaces for the performance of identity. And that's always been the case. And particularly, I mean, those fears and concerns over teenagers in particular. I mean, the number of letters I've read written to editors in the 19th century and things with concerns over groups of young ruffians. I wonder how much you feel that you mentioned Brexit and this kind of increasingly divided society. If there is a role you maybe see for parks in negotiating some of that, especially if these are spaces which are so important to all of us to go and express our identity, could it be a space that could maybe address some of those divisions?
I think so. And I think I've seen some examples of that recently with some work I've been doing with the Manchester Art Gallery, Platt Hall specifically, in Platt Fields, where we've been exploring how to take the museum into the park. So those of you who know about Platt Hall, you'll know it used to be the Manchester Costume Gallery or Museum of Textiles. It closed relatively recently and, you know, it has these kind of huge fans of the textiles. The costumes in there are amazing. It has an amazing collection, and it's actually not just textiles. It also has various art collections. It has an incredible collection of Mary Gregg, these sort of everyday objects, domestic objects of everyday life. It has something like 30,000 buttons. So it's this kind of treasure trove, but it's also at the edge of and overlooking this incredible park, Platt Fields, which was saved by the local authority. All the people of Manchester, in that classic way, at the turn of the 20th century, had previously been a parkland, a private estate, has various other kind of historic artifacts in it in terms of in its space, and is in the centre of three wards in Manchester, Fallowfields and Rusholme and Moss Side, that are highly diverse. And so you've got a real opportunity there for something that is both speaking to the built heritage and the natural heritage of that area, the community heritages that exist now contemporaneously around it, and then also its collections. But it was closed because of a moth infestation, and now it's looking to redevelop itself as a community-led constituent museum. And then, of course, it's closed because of lockdown in any case. So some of the work we were doing was trying to engage the museum into the park and trying to use digital means. So Manchester City Council, they license an app called Love Exploring, which is about supporting active participation from families or from anyone who wants to take part in different ways in parks and in natural environments. What we did was we took some of the objects and we've put them digitally around the park to try to get people to explore them and get them to engage with the collections in the museum and to get people walking around the space. And Platfields has a huge amount of different zones. I know many parks do, but it seems almost excessive in Platfields, the amount of different kinds of activities, the different groups you can go, you know, there's the boating lake, which of course is used for model boats. There's the skate park and cycling. There's a cycle hub. There's a community garden. There's a museum. There's all other kinds of things that happen. It's a very much an events park. And just to get back to your point about how parks are places where people do a sort of politics, really. It's also the site where they've been campaigning. I wasn't witnessing it, but it was in the media that quite early on in lockdown, there were anti-lockdown protests in there. But there was also, after the Black Lives Matter moment, the park began to be used just outside of Platt Hall on the plinth where the Abraham Lincoln statue used to stand. That statue was donated to the people of Manchester because of their support for the abolition of slavery. And then it's been moved since. So I think it's in Lincoln Square and it's, you know, moved to the city centre. So there's this plinth where actually a lot of people remember that heritage of the statue being there. They know what that space is, but actually newer communities who've moved into the area perhaps don't. And so some local community members began to use the plinth for a weekly kneel. And they kind of celebrated and protested for anti-racism and had this very performative way of just outside the hall where it made a kind of natural stage there. So I've been thinking about that and looking at that and also thinking about how it sits in some ways in tension with what the hall stands for as this place that was a private estate. So that's just one example of how people can gather together and how sometimes that produces tensions, but those tensions are important.
I'm really struck by how people continue to reinvent the structures in parks, and the meaning behind them really does change and alter over time with the different audiences. So I was involved in a project in Whitworth Park looking at the obelisk sculpture, which was a piece of modern art which the Whitworth Art Gallery commissioned to go on an old plinth, which had once had this very old-fashioned Christ blessing little children sculpture there that had been damaged during the war and had been removed. And did a bit of a project around the origin of the materials used. And originally the artist's idea was to use concrete from the Hume Crescents as a sort of failed building project. And he was really interested in the idea of modern ruins. But then it also integrated this moss-side red brick. And it's in this very imperialistic shape of the obelisk. And when people heard the stories, they really adapted it to, instead of thinking of it as a ruined monument of two crumbling old buildings, they saw it as this connection, this uniting of these two areas, Mossside and Hume, which typically have got a bit of rivalry between them, but saw it as this bringing together and this uniting. So really those objects in parks, almost because it's a public space for everyone, they can just get reinterpreted in however people want to see them, or, you know, whatever is meaningful to them. The example you give of that plinth again being used, that's a really nice example of how the parks continually get reinvented just through the usage of them.
I just want to take that into thinking, in my own thinking for the research, because I'm at the moment I'm trying to explore, you mentioned it in an earlier question, about why is it that the parks are apparently more inclusive than other more institutionalized cultural forms. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons, is because we can literally practice them into being as public spaces.
The idea of the museum in the park, it's such a common idea. I mean, so many parks wanted to, whether or not they got built or not, so many of the early designs for them included museums or art galleries or some sort of way of showing a particular aspect. So, you know, technical industry, museum to industry, or greenhouses with different plants from around the world showing the British Empire at work. But within those spaces, there's a lot more tension, because almost with the surveillance aspect of it. So you can only act in certain ways in there, and particularly at a time when, in their emergence, when people weren't sure how to use those spaces. They're quite new spaces. There was a lot of tension. But I think even still, there is a real sense of belonging or not belonging, whereas the park is much more open and much more accessible, and there's a clearer understanding of how you can use the space. It's really interesting that they are more open and more open to interpretation. You mentioned lockdown a couple of times, and I wondered if we could just touch on how people have been using parks during lockdown. Has our usage of these spaces changed, or has it become more important, or what's been going on this year?
Yeah, there's quite a lot of things that haven't been going on this year, so I suppose that might be one answer or explanation. I mean, I haven't been doing any consistent empirical research into behaviour, so I wouldn't want to make claims on the basis of my own research. And I was very lucky, and quite early in during the pandemic, during lockdown, I would manage to join a group of academics who basically formed a kind of parks in the pandemic group from a range of different disciplines. Criminology, sociological perspective. Andrew Smith is based at Westminster and he looks at events and parks, particularly London parks, and he's done a lot of empirical work with friends groups that are sort of exploring their approaches to the management of space and how public parks can be, in a term that I would use, enclosed through the putting on of events because they become privatised or semi-privatised. And actually that's a framework that I've been trying to think about in terms of, you know, parks as heritage spaces too, about how they might become semi-public. So couching that, this is from anecdotal observation at my time spent in parks, you know, I think it's fair to say that we will have recognised that parks are really adaptable, that people have, I wouldn't say they're necessarily using them differently, I think it's just enhanced, isn't it? I think, you know, the fact that we have seen people engaging, there is empirical research that shows through using things like geolocated data tracking, so Google, basically, they've been able to show how there's been increased usage of parks. And I'm sure that there's also other indicators to show the increased usage. For example, Councillor Rahman from Manchester, the City Council, has written to the government to ask for more funding because parks have been able to demonstrate their value so much more to people when there haven't been other places that we can go to, or there haven't been places where they've been the greatest places to exercise and to see other people. And one of the indicators he uses is he talks about the amount of litter that is in the park, which of course is a huge maintenance cost and is a problem for local authorities. So I think, you know, that clearly there's been a massive increase of use. And I know also that particularly at the beginning in lockdown in Manchester, parks teams were finding it difficult because they had to lock spaces up and they had to find ways of avoiding parks becoming destinations. If a park had a toilet that was open, it was like a, you know, a prime park because you could go and spend all day there comfortably. But that meant that you might get more crowds, which meant that they had to manage those crowds, let alone the litter that then resulted from them. So I think people have just got more comfortable and have used them more. Certainly, anecdotally, from where I live in Macclesfield, a thing that really kind of struck me was going to the park nearest to me very, very frequently, going in that beautiful time where the air was clear during lockdown. It felt really clean. It was a summer evening. And there was the park was pretty full. And there was somebody who had obviously been there for a little while, maybe had taken a couple of cans with him, maybe they'd had a group of friends they'd been meeting there, but he had like a pink blanket over him, and I think it was like a sort of youngish man, and he was just there on his own, sort of lying down, sitting up on his elbows and looking over the park in this beautiful light with this little pink rug over him. It was just like he was in his living room watching the TV or something, and I just thought that was really, really struck me. Another indicator I just want to mention quickly, which is a lockdown thing, is you could just measure the increase of value of parks by the number of cockapoos in them. So, you know, there are swarms of them in Macclesfield, and I'm sure in other places too.
It's a bit of a speculative question, Abby, but do you think that this experience through 2020 and that real re-recognition of the cultural value of parks in a way that we haven't necessarily been asked to recognise in the past 10 years, do you think that will create a step change in support for the park, and particularly support for those local green spaces who have been most at risk of cuts to funding, and those small little parks that, you know, aren't the big city centre ones?
Again, an excellent question, and one that's really troubling me and others at the moment, including the group I mentioned earlier, the Parks at Pandemic group. It's that problem about how do you keep demonstrating the value to government and hope that that means that you'll get further investment, it doesn't seem to work. So I think that there's a fundamental issue that, and you both might be able to help me with this, and I'm sure others can too, that I'm trying to work through, which is what's going on with policy. And I see parks as very much part of cultural policy, the cultural policy places. I'm interested in how cultural policy is not a top-down national strategy that sits and goes onto places. I'm interested in how policy works through things like the management, creation of different sorts of public space. A cultural economics perspective on parks would say that parks have their own intrinsic value. They have extrinsic value in terms of the economic value that they denote on the areas close by. They obviously have value to strategies for social cohesion. They have health benefits. They have well-being benefits. You know, you can do all the kind of natural capital stuff. And yet it doesn't seem to make the arguments work. And I think partly that's because one of the things that we found out through the research for the UEP project was that even though, and I've been thinking about this in terms of the commons model a lot, even though people will contribute to a commons space in the way that they participate in public parks, and even though they highly value them, they find it very difficult, possibly because of the resources that they can bring to it, to be part of their management. So the fact that they may feel like they belong and that they have ownership over certain parts of the public space there or at certain times of the day or year, actually, quite a lot of the people were just saying, well, why aren't the local authorities looking after it? Because they're the actual owners and they're the public sector and they're supposed to be helping us. And of course, the local authorities are completely embattled and have been for the last decade, as we know, and it's going to get so much worse. And where parks sit within their overall strategy, I think, seems to be really important. I mean, Manchester is one of those places that does cultural strategy pretty well. It's very proud of itself for that. It puts its money where its mouth is. It invested in cultural flagships when austerity was first hitting. And now it's doing the same again by campaigning and lobbying that its parks need further investment. But at the end of the day, it has a lot of park space to look after and no resources. And then there's also something around the actual economics of parks in that they have very little asset value that sits on local authorities' books. So they actually don't have that much value, partly because they were gifted spaces. So there's this complex conundrum. And I should reference my good friend and colleague, Virginia Tandy, who has also done a lot of work looking at the relationship between the Heritage Lottery Fund and the heritage value in parks. And she also got a long-standing experience in working in local authorities as previous director of arts for Manchester. You know, she was the one that kind of identified this issue about the asset value of parks and how that's created a problem for future. I think the problem of parks is it's the business model and all of the brilliant work demonstrating its value and rethinking parks into new business models, which HLF and Nesta have been investing in and a variety of people have been putting loads of work into. I'm not sure if we've resolved that issue. And maybe there isn't one single model.
I'm really struck by when you talk of HLF, obviously quite a few parks got funding over the past 10 years and things. And it really does seem to be that a lot of that funding went to restoring a Victorian heyday image of the park rather than reflecting some of the newer changes and how people are using them today. And I wonder if that's part of, as well, the people who are campaigning for those parks, friends groups have been amazing in kind of stepping into that breach. But as you were saying, a lot of people who use the parks feel those barriers to becoming part of the management. A lot of friends groups who I worked with had backgrounds in planning, backgrounds that would make them ideal to help with that, but maybe aren't as broad and inclusive a management group as could be. And I know a lot of them wanted to address that as well and bring new people in, but we almost have then that absence of a management structure gets filled by a group with particular viewpoints, and that actually works in tension with the way that people are organically using the space. So yeah, I think there's quite a bit of work to be done to negotiate how that can be taken forward and how we can safeguard the futures and the importance that they've shown to have, but for the future as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely bang on. I think that's really well articulated. And that's why thinking about it from a commons model perspective sort of works, because you have to understand how commons are based on participation, but they're also based on a certain amount of regulation. So you have, there's a concern about the tragedy of the commons, that if you let everybody in, then the stuff runs out. Now, obviously, there are other, well, there's Eleanor Ostrom's work, famous work, which is challenging the idea of the tragedy of commons and talks about common pool resources. And parks can very much operate, or their management can very much operate in the way that they are looking after common pool resources, even if they're owned by somebody else, a local authority, or in the case of the Mayfield Park, I'm not sure who exactly is going to own that park, we'll find out. But commons require, in order to be able to participate in commons, you need to understand what the rules are, but you also have to have a stake in the rules. So you have to help to be able to produce the rules, and then you can manage those resources collectively. And I think, like you say, if there are certain people that are ostensibly leading or managing and have come from certain value frameworks or positions, the sort of exclusions that might happen from the commons are ones that need to be negotiated and negotiated out. It's a similar kind of model for thinking about arts and culture in the communities. It's how do you distribute the resources and support the collective participation in the management of those resources so that a whole range of different values and viewpoints can be included and can support a more commons understanding of why assets like parks or creativity or participation in the arts are important in everyday life.
This idea of inclusivity and open for all can be really challenging, though, when we really think about what that means. Parks used to be referred to as your outside sitting room. So, you know, there's supposed to be this idea you could use as an additional space to live in. And so your young man lying there with his pink blanket up, that's a wonderful vision of it. But I remember when doing the Whitworth Park Archaeology and History project, we were excavating and a couple of homeless men came and talked to us about what we were doing and got talking to them. And they said how actually they used to live in the park on this weeping willow tree, and they used to live underneath the branches, and they treated it as it was their home, and they had a kind of a family unit. But when they started locking the parks again at night, they couldn't use the space anymore, and the family dissipated, and so never really saw each other again. So that idea of it being an additional living space and accessible for all, we really have to take stock of what does that really mean. And there are certain uses of it that we might not see as being quite so savory, but are just as important and need to be taken into consideration as well. So that image of the young man with the blanket, we think, amazing. The idea of some homeless people sleeping there doesn't fit in the same way with our value systems, and that, yet aren't they really doing the same things? There's a lot of work still to be done to really get to the bottom of it all, or to make sure that we protect our parks going forward. Do you have anything else to add, Abby?
No, other than that, it's been wonderful to talk to you both about this, that there should be some kind of, I don't know, we need a help group, but certainly...
I think so.
The parks obsessives, once they get hold of you, that's it, really. Keep getting pulled back to the importance of these spaces. And, you know, and there are so many, we could carry on talking for quite a long time, because I'm sure there are so many stories that we've got either from history or from observation or from research. When we set up that park support group, then... Yep. We'll be open and inclusive too. So
absolutely. And I think we'll have to meet probably with a bottle of wine in a park. So thank you so much. It's really been wonderful talking to you as well.
Likewise. Thank you.
That brings our parks mini series to a close. And we hope you've enjoyed listening as much as we have enjoyed discussing it. We would love you to share your thoughts about the series and your memories and the pictures of the parks that are really special to you. You can find us on Our Stories Heritage on Instagram and Our Stories HRTG on Twitter.
Next time, we're diving into something brand new, and we'll be bringing you the tale of Gertrude Powick, Stockport native, university graduate, and on the front line in the First World War. We'll also be joined by the co-founder of Our Stories Heritage, the fabulous Kate Turner. We will see you then.
Tales of Ordinary Times is an Our Stories production and is presented, produced and edited by Ruth Colton and Emma Richmond. To find out more about Our Stories, visit www.ourstories.co.